It is Saturday, January 7th, 2006, 10 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today's rundown, geek news, space update, online music video, municipality technology, and during the second half of the show, your questions and comments.
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
Confused yet? You will be, because it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on our program, we'll focus on geek news. Then we'll go into a discussion about space and what's going on there, online music and video, some technology that municipalities are going into. And during the second half of the show, we'll stop talking about us and our thoughts and start talking about yours. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or you can contact us now by going to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. Geek Speak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry, using digital technology for less radiation, and offering one-appointment crowns and veneers. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. This is Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is almost every geek we've ever had on Geek Speak. John Tracy, technical support engineer at Surf Control. Miles Elam, also at Surf Control, the technical trainer. Sean Cleveland, technical marketing manager at NVIDIA. Drew Meyer, product manager at Network Appliance. He's very technical, by the way. And Chris Dumphy, software entrepreneur and business developer.
Slacker.
Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Back, Chris.
But he's a technical slacker.
And Didi, we miss slacker. You.
And Didi, we miss you. Yes, definitely. Okay, we're going to get into our longer format discussions on some great topics. But let's do some news cap. We got a lot of news this week because of CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, which is going on right now. And some predictions probably for next week when Macintosh announces their new things. The news today, I think we'll start with first person to look up at me. Chris, you got news? No, you just looked at me because you didn't have anything to say. Miles, what's up, man?
As another show of zero tolerance around the country, an 18-year-old boy was recently arrested in Ohio, a high school student, for refreshing a school's webpage. Basically, what he did was posted to a site saying, hey, everyone, go to my school's website and press and hold the F5 key, F5 being what you do to reload a website. And it brought the site down. The city prosecutor for Canton, Ohio, charged him with a felony.
Wait. The website went down?
Is that normal? He basically performed a denial of service attack?
Right, because too many people were hitting the server. The server wasn't particularly robust.
Okay. So he told other students to try refreshing?
Right.
Okay.
And at the same time, it was charged with a felony. Like, you'd think of someone goes and they spray paint a school, it's a misdemeanor at most, and most of the times you would get detention or something like that.
But this one's a cybercrime.
Right, because it's a cybercrime.
What are you in for? I hit F5.
He's so doomed in the slammer.
Right, with murderers and rapists, and goes, what did you do? I hit F5, and the murderers and rapists moved down the bench a little bit.
So, Miles, I mean, I've configured web servers incorrectly, and there's a thing specifically in web server that has to do with the amount of time your connection stays open to the web server. So the web server specifies the browser connection will stay open for a certain period of time, and that actually reserves kind of space to keep alive. And I guess on some browsers, I'm assuming a refresh would actually force a new keep alive. So it's something like that. It's a configuration problem with the web server.
It's just a general load, because once the browser thinks that the connection is over, in other words, after it's received all this information, it usually will not leave the socket open.
Okay, so we're talking about, that's good. But how did this happen? Because it's not just one person pushing F5. There's no way one web browser could take
it
down.
Right, he posted to
all of his buddies.
Blog, yeah.
Like 100 people saying, like, all went there at the same time and refreshed the page, and the server went, ah,
right.
Freak.
It was a prank. I mean, he...
Gotcha. He got everybody
He was trying to...
So he did try to do it. Okay.
Yes.
Well, then he's being a criminal. No, of course not. All right, well, thank
but
you.
But because it's technology.
Can you kind of keep us apprised? I'd love to know if he gets prosecuted on it.
Sure.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Miles, for that. Next news story, I will go to Sean Cleveland. Hi.
Hi. So this week was the big show in down in L.A., CES.
Consumer Electronics Show.
And this is where all the cool new gadgets and electronic toys, well, more than that, actually, were launched this week.
It's like the definition of the industry.
It's become the new Comdex, they say.
It's the biggest show in the U.S.
So this week, there was a big push to get computers once again into the living rooms, media center PCs. Intel launched a new platform called Vive, spelled V-I-I-V. And with this, they're pledging that their hardware will work with new satellite technologies, high definition, that sort of thing. Analysts are seeing it as another large play by Intel to get their branding to push their hardware. So to qualify for Vive, it's got to have an Intel processor, Intel chipset.
Gotcha.
You know, it's got to be all Intel.
No,
it's going to be like Centrino for notebook.
And is Intel actually producing the software that will run on this thing? Is that probably going to offer a package? Or
no. And that's the thing. They've been trying to get computers in the living rooms for a long time, but it's been the content that has made it fail.
Right.
It's just not there.
Right.
AMD launched Live to compete with Intel's Vive, but from what people can see, again, that's just computer hardware under, you know, being packaged under a brand.
It's this branding that to the end user won't matter at all.
It's like what logo is going to be on the front. But this time they're backing it up with strategic partnerships. So Intel is working with movie studios and TV stations, and Google and Yahoo have launched their own online internet audio video presence.
And we're going to talk a lot about this in a little bit later in the show.
Right.
We'll
and I think that's what's really going to make this stuff work.
Now, isn't TiVo already the biggest kind of unit like of this form in the living room space right now?
Yeah, but TiVo's not really delivering on demand yet.
But they will. I would just assume that they just take over that space. It seems to me that, I mean, most TiVo boxes have network connections.
Right.
You just have to have high speed, and pretty soon your TiVo is. I mean, it seems to me that putting the hardware in there, having people have great experiences with it, being able to record and play their television in new ways, they define the space. Anybody else is just going to be compared to them.
But TiVo is under a ton of pressure about digital rights management because they're trying to avoid being able to copy content and distribute it around to your friends. So right now, TiVo, I've worked with them a little bit in the storage industry, and it's difficult. We haven't been able to figure out a way to get content from the TiVo to, say, your network where your storage is so you can play it on demand, like Sean was mentioning, and have lots and lots of capacity. You can save everything you want forever.
You can do that now.
Only in the TiVo format.
Only in TiVo format.
Let's keep discussing this and when we bring up digital or online music and video in just a few minutes.
Sure.
Let's keep on doing a couple news headlines. John, I'm going to go to you, sir. News?
All right. My news story has a little bit of history.
Please.
Let's go back to 1957.
I've heard of that year.
Yeah. Russia launched a satellite called Sputnik, first people in space. In 1961, Russia launched...
There were no people on Sputnik.
There were no people on Sputnik. But in 1961, they launched a craft carrying the first astronaut in space, cosmonaut. And then that started, you know, the whole space race, see who can get to the moon first. You know, we got there in 1969. So it came as kind of a surprise to me that just before the year ended last year, NASA signed a contract with Russia asking if we could put astronauts on their Soyuz craft for the price of, you know, $21.8 million per seat. And a little bit of... No, for astronauts. Not for
Chris.
Chris is raising his hand. He wants to be next. For astronauts, because currently the U.S. has no space vehicle that works to get people
into
space.
Well, it's not reliable. Shuttles are down right now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So... It seems kind of an interesting turn of events that we, quote, won the space race, and yet here we are leasing, for the next 6 months, we have a contract signed to put people on Russian spacecraft to get them up to the ISS. And
so that is news.
Sounds like we're outsourcing our space program, like everything else.
I said IIS, didn't I?
Yeah.
not International Space Station.
And it's interesting how...
Your job is interfering with your geekhood.
It is.
Companies are using Russian rockets to get their satellites up.
Yep. Yeah, the Saturn V is not being used nearly as much as the rest of
it. Really interesting.
Yeah. All right, thanks for that. Any more news stories? Should we go into the topics? I think we shall. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning are Miles Elam, Drew Meyer, Chris Dumphy, Sean Cleveland, and that was John Tracy's news report about space. And I think since we just mentioned space, let's talk a little bit about what's going on Mars and in the outer solar system.
Sir? Oh, what's going on Mars?
No, on Mars, there are these little robotic creatures on Mars.
We have they're still running, right? Spirit.
Extended warranty in effect.
Right. Yeah, they were. Yeah, as Chris said, they paid the extra $800 and got the extended warranty on them. They were put up over 2 years ago for the first one for Spirit, and Opportunity is coming up on 2 years. At the
what kind of lifespan did they have expected?
90-day. Was the expected
so 3 months
lifespan.
And they've been up for 2 years.
So NASA hit a home run.
So NASA, hit a home
hit run. A grand I think
they
slam.
Should make, I think they should make cookie cutters of these craft and just keep just sending them out to different
places.
Send
them on every planetary body in our solar system. Just get them out there.
We know that they work.
Don't change a thing, especially with software.
They're saying the increased longevity is due to two things. One, there's been unpredicted dust storms, which have cleaned off the solar panels. These are, they have solar panels recharging.
When you say a dust storm, cleaning glass doesn't seem to be one of the things that happens.
You think it would abrade the glass?
You think it would be damaging,
which is what they expect. But the dust storms are just right. They're cleaning off the glass and not
nice,
destroying
gentle
the
storms and almost no
atmosphere. The other thing is the programming and engineering team that they've got, because we've got a captive rover, on Earth that we play with. Well, not we. NASA.
It's on a little leash.
Chris is raising his hand on that one, too. I want to play with it.
And the software engineering team behind that has been able to overcome every obstacle that's come up so far. And
we're talking about getting into lower pits that they expected.
We've talked about technical problems, design flaws that became apparent. They've been able to software code around those. When the wheels got stuck, they were able to software code around those. When one of the batteries started discharging, they couldn't figure out why. They were able to software code around those. So they've been able to upload all these new software algorithms that have overcome every problem that the rovers have experienced.
So, John, after 2 years, how far have these rovers gone?
A whole 7 miles combined.
Wow. That's
combined,
man.
Which isn't that much. If you go up to JPL's site and you look at the map and how far they've gone, it's not significant. We haven't really covered a lot of Mars. But the cool thing is the rovers landed in the optimum places to find what they were looking for, which is traces of water. So they have found traces of water. They've met the mission requirements. Traces of water. They found them.
I mean, they did that
grindy
in the first
sand, right?
That's what their period of life, the 90 days, was for. Was to do their missions, and the missions have been done for a year and a half. It's pretty impressive.
So right now they're sending one of the rovers. I can't remember which one down to a crater called Victoria Crater, where they expect to be able to look down into the crater and look down through 400 million years of Mars history. Is what they're hoping to expect.
So they don't move very fast, but they look really well.
Yeah, they have a rock abrading tool that can erode the surface of the rock so they can look and see what the rock is past all the gunk that's on the top of the rock.
An hour ago, Don started a show talking about the benefits of science and discussing a little bit about that. And I kind of want to tie this into something I'm feeling about the rovers. Every time I hear about the rovers on Mars, I think, at least they're not alone. It's like this emotional state I have, which is completely ridiculous, of course, especially since they're millions of miles or thousands of miles away from each other, even. But this idea that, are they going to get them together at the end before they die,
so they have too a little far apart. Thing.
I'm kind of worried about this.
I want a happy ending.
this captive rover on Earth, he is alone. And what if he breaks free? He's the one who's lonely. He wants to get back to Mars.
He's going to make a prison break.
With all these bags of water.
Send him a file.
Well, John, thanks for the update on it. You had a little bit more you want to mention before
that's it on Mars.
Okay, 2 years. Congratulations on Mars for the rovers. Okay, what's going on in deep space exploration?
Well, it's not quite deep space. Still planetary space. How many planets do we have in our solar system?
We used to have 9, right?
We used to have 9. In school, we all learned it's 9. Now we have either 8 or 17 and counting, depending on if you consider Pluto to be a planet or not. We've found 8 more objects beyond Pluto that are 1,000 kilometers or greater, which is bigger than Pluto.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, as big as Pluto or greater. These are in the Kuiper Belt, which is outside of the range of Pluto. Pluto is some people consider it a planet. Some people consider it a trans-Neptunian object, which is a fancy way of saying it's a fancy way of saying it's outside the orbit of Neptune.
It gives it a complex too.
planets outside of 3.
I want to be a
trans Earth planet,
but it's only sometimes outside the orbit of Neptune, though.
Sometimes it's inside, right?
So, what do you believe, John? 8 or 17?
It really depends on your definition of a planet.
What's your definition? What do you think?
My definition, we have 8. I think it's a big old ice ball floating around.
You mean you demoted Pluto through all this?
Yeah.
Okay, it's a great argument. I mean, the general idea is that Pluto is just like, now do the math real quick, 9 more objects that are out there, right? Or 8 more objects that are out there. And if you're going to count it as a planet, you're going to count those other objects as a planet. So make your decision.
It reverses the balance. It's always been we've had the 8 planets, and then this other one that's been kind of an anomaly. Now we're realizing the inner planets, if those are planets, the inner planets become the anomaly, and the Kuiper objects become the norm.
Right.
Because there are hundreds of thousands of objects out there. And if you go out to the Oort cloud, which is way, 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 way out there, you get 300 to 400 million objects.
Let's do that standing thing with your hand above your head, because it's really fun, especially for radio. Okay. So basically, if you stand up, if you're
hold,
about John's
hold your hand
height,
out
right?
in front of you. Hold your hand out in front of you. Spread your fingers.
Okay.
The very center of your hand is the sun.
Ouch.
Yeah, it's a hot place. Your fingers represent the inner five planets.
Okay.
Inner four planets. Hold the hand above your head. Stand up. Well, don't, you guys. You're all tethered in with headphones.
But and if you're driving, stand up.
If that's the inner planets, your hand, Pluto is about where your feet would be.
Okay.
Wow.
It's a roughly.
But Neptune and such is along the way.
Right, yeah. Okay. Neptune,
body,
you know. Yeah.
Navel, that kind of thing. Okay.
Well, yeah, Neptune's about where your
okay.
shin
Where's
is.
Where's this
yeah.
cloud that has other Plutonian-type things?
Well, if you're talking about the Kuiper objects, it would be, you know, outside the door where you're standing,
okay.
kind of.
You know, assuming
the
buildings
it'd be
are
pretty far away.
Okay.
And then for us, the Oort cloud would be, like San Jose.
Okay, so we're talking miles away.
Yeah.
We're in Santa Cruz right
yeah.
now.
Yeah, so if you look at the entire solar system out to Pluto, if we're counting Pluto as a planet, it would be just a little dot compared to the Oort cloud.
Right. And I think this is really telling. I mean, I've been doing a lot of playing with Google Earth, which if you're on a Windows machine, it's a definite go try. It's free. Google Earth, you need high-speed access. In any case, Earth's really big. You can tell from that Google Earth thing because you can see all these different satellite stuff. And when we start talking these kind of volumes of size, you really get the magnitude of doing something like sending a craft out there. So we're about to send a craft out, right?
That's yeah, sometime this month, we're going to be launching Horizons.
Which goes where?
To do what? Yeah.
Which is going to be going out to investigate Pluto. First, it's going to swing by. Okay, it's launching 2006. In 1 year, it's going to make it to Jupiter. That's how fast it's moving. It's going to use Jupiter as a gravity slingshot, which means it's going to pick up a whole bunch of speed. And then it's going to take it another 10 years to get out to Pluto and the Kuiper Belt. And it's going to go out and it's going to explore.
And see.
It's going to be the first time we've ever had an in-depth look at Pluto.
Are we going to get really good video from it?
Yes, actually.
Will it be online?
Yeah, most likely.
Most
yeah.
likely.
This is
going to
be in 15 years, though, huh?
Yes, definitely. Speaking of online video.
Yeah.
Good
Chris,
segue.
Hey, thanks, man. John, thank you very much for the space
That's
update.
Cool, John,
really appreciate
man.
It. I'm glad that you're back
great.
On GeekSpeak. It's wonderful that we're able to be on a new time, and John's actually able to join us. Thank you very much for being here. Chris. What's going on with, first off, you talked about this online music radio thing. Tell me about it.
So I've just discovered this amazing website called Pandora.com, and it had the effect of me, like, you know, the first time you saw Google years and years ago of, like, just something super simple. You type in what you're looking for, and you get it. It's the same thing for music. You type in, on Pandora, you type in either a song or a band that you like, and it will find other music and start playing it for you instantly.
That's like that band or music.
That's like that band or like that song. And so you start finding other songs and other bands that are similar, and it's just a free, completely free internet radio station that's customized to exactly what you want to hear.
You mean it plays the music for you?
Yeah, yeah. It'll
play songs, yeah, that you, let's say you specify a band.
Like
it'll,
Rush.
It'll play that band,
mm-hmm.
But it'll also find other songs that are similar from other bands.
It's interesting because it's...
And then you rate it with a thumbs up or a thumbs down, and basically start building your own little radio station.
I mean, it's that benefit of a good DJ, you know, somebody that really knows their music. They'll play something. You hear this all the time on KOSP on our music shows. You hear a song, you're like, oh, I've heard that song, or maybe I haven't heard that song, and I like it. And the next song has some kind of similarity to it and has a feel for it because the person that's behind that type of music knows their music really well.
Right.
And that's a skill set that always hits me as a very impressive thing. Sure, I can talk about technology all the time.
It sounds like a music spam filter.
It does.
No, this is junk. Oh, this is good.
Yeah.
So it's
in a way, it kind of is.
Because one of the problems with, like, if I were to have to fill in on a music show, I would grab an album, and if I liked it, I'd play the whole thing, which would be really bad. But it would also be illegal. Your radio stations, and definitely online, the same thing. You're not supposed to play a whole album or a whole bunch of work from a certain artist. Sometimes stations get away with this because they've got enough money in the industry and stuff that it's not a problem. But the general idea is if you play an entire album, someone can be at home and record the album off air, and therefore they can make dupes of it, and that's not good for the music industry, for the artists. So it's interesting that this format would allow you to not do that. You put in Rush, but you actually get a whole bunch of types of music, and I'm using Rush because it's Sean's favorite band, but you get a whole bunch of music styled like that. The question I have is, how do they do it?
So they keep track of what you've heard, and they keep you from, you can skip a song, you can skip ahead. If there's a song you're playing you don't like, you can press the skip button and it'll go ahead, but you can't go back, and you can't, like, specify,
yeah,
I want to hear something I heard before. If you just wait, you know, an hour or so later, you might hear the same song
yeah,
again.
It'll come around.
But they enforce that they'll only give you songs that fit that pattern, that stay legal. So
and
they won't play
just
too much Rush, they won't play too much of anything that's
Yeah. At some point, you'll want to expand it, too. And okay. you'll add more artists and songs, and it kind of changes and grows.
And this is called?
This is Pandora.com. And it one of the other nice things is they wrote the application in Macromedia Flash, and it runs on Windows, Mac, and Linux. So it's completely cross-platform. You just go to it in your browser. You never leave your browser. Type in your favorite song, and it'll start finding stuff that's like it. It's really, really cool.
Sounds like the Gnusic application. You guys heard of that? Where you put in a band name, and they ask you like 5 questions, and then they make some recommendations based on the band name. And
of
the more
other
you
bands.
Use it, yeah. And then they give you a little view of what everybody else who's been to the site, kind of the opinion bar chart of what the
what's this site?
Gnusic, Gnoosic.
Well, you were talking Pandora actually does that kind of thing too, of rating.
Yeah, they have what's behind Pandora is something called the Music Genome Project, where they say it takes them 30 hours per album, and they've listened to hundreds of thousands of albums to manually go through and have music experts talk about, like, analyze each song. And so they do it per song, not per artist. So there might be a song from Willie Nelson that's rocking out that they'll then match with other rock songs and stuff. They'll analyze the vocal harmonies. They'll analyze the use of rhythm. They'll analyze the instruments. And so when they're finding songs that are similar, they're finding stuff that really is similar at a song-by-song level, you know, down to things like rhythm and use of vocals.
Doesn't that take a while to do that?
They say 30 hours per album. Somebody manually analyzing an album for 30 hours.
That seems a little insane. I mean, 30 hours for an album, I mean, come on. The amount of music just in this room would take hundreds of years. I mean, it doesn't. I guess if you're spreading that out between all the users that use the system, it maybe starts working.
They've been doing the analysis, I guess, for about 5 or 6 years now, mm-hmm. and they say they've got the largest collection of analyzed music in existence in the world.
That's great. Yeah. All right.
Is there a subscription fee?
Pandora is completely free right now. They have a. The free version is free, and they say that for $35 a year, I think you can subscribe, in which case eventually they'll start inserting ads into the free version, and the subscribed version will be completely ad-free.
Okay, so that's Pandora.com, and you mentioned, Drew, you mentioned one. What's that one?
Gnusic, Gnoosic, and I'm pronouncing that in the traditional GNU fashion, so if you prefer Gnusic, that's fine as well.
And it's
we're in the middle of time. We're searching right now. Gnoosic.
Okay, there you go. And that's a little bit about what's going on music. Let's talk. I mean, Google is also using for their video feed. They're using Flash Player, and it's nice because it works on multiple platforms, and you can stream the content and all of that stuff. I'm not sure if Google is caching their video or not, but Google just made an announcement that kind of fits in this realm. What's Google doing now?
So Google has announced at CES a whole bunch of new pay-per-view video features. So you'll be able to get CBS TV shows and rent them for $1.99, and also NBA games and watch them via Google Video, as well as access to a lot of old TV shows like, you know, Star Trek and I Love Lucy and stuff that you could buy and download the episodes from Google.
When you say rent, is it a rent process? You're supposed to get rid of it, or is it a buy process?
Well, I think the based on the article I've read is the new shows like the brand new on the air CBS shows are rented, so you only have like a certain amount of time to view them. But if you get the old classics like Star Trek and I Love Lucy, you can watch them as many times as you want.
And are these things then that they're kind of streamed through? Like you load the page and then you have access to play it, but once you go away, it goes away? Not sure.
I have to go double check. But the one thing that was really cool about the Google announcement is that they're going to let people like you and me and you know, John and his son have made some amazing videos. You could upload your own videos, set a price, and let people buy them through Google Video.
They're not. They made deals with CBS Television, NBA Basketball. You watch classic TV and games. But they're making this available to everybody. Right. So if you've got a great video you think is worth $10, you could upload it and charge people.
You can start watching the John Tracy channel.
And Google gets 30%.
Wow.
Okay, so you start by putting the really good stuff up and making it almost free.
Or free.
And then people get hooked on it, and then you start increasing the price. Hey.
Yeah, it sounds like a marketing plan.
I think we could kick.
And Robin Williams was there at the show.
Oh, yeah, CES.
To help launch this. Yeah, at CES.
So Robin Williams pushed this idea.
From what I understand, he just went nuts like he always does and kind of took over the whole announcement.
Excellent.
He kind of trumped the CEO of Google.
So, you know, it's kind of interesting. There was Robin Williams at CES this year.
Yeah, Tom Cruise was on stage with Yahoo.
And
there were, yeah, I guess
Freeman
they showed off his Mission Impossible 3 preview. It's probably tied in. I don't know if Yahoo should have taken the Mission Impossible you know, theme.
Yahoo, not so smart, Yahoo beating Google, Mission Impossible.
You know, not at all. I got to say that some of the features that, and the reason why Google's been so successful is that it's got a great search engine, which is just a matter of time before someone else comes up with a good, better one. And it's also got this great support for web developers to use their services, really good APIs. Well, Yahoo's trumping them left and right on their APIs. The interfaces for interacting with Google content, I mean, with Yahoo content, is getting better and better, such that I'm back and forth. If I want to implement a good search engine on my site, I'm not sure if I'm going to go with Google anymore. I'm kind of thinking about Yahoo. And I know the market is still like Google's top-notch, everybody.
No kidding. But what specifically?
Well, let's say Yahoo is its APIs to do searches. It used to be that you pretty
much...
And
this is the programming interface if you're actually going
right.
to build this into your software.
I haven't done a lot of development in Yahoo. I'm taking this mostly from word of mouth from other people that have been implementing. But it used to be that if you wanted to search your pages from Yahoo, there wasn't an interface to do that. You couldn't really do it. Google, right off the bat, anytime you do a search, you can actually add the word site, colon, and put a URL.
Right.
And it will restrict the search just to that site.
As long as you put their logo up, their little Google.
Right. And in fact, you can even get signed in for free in their system, and they will put your logo on their page. But anytime you want to do a search specifically to a site, let's say you want to search KUSP site because you heard about something recently. So you search, music, and then put site, colon, KUSP, you'll get only pages on KUSP site that has music. It's a great way of using better search technology than most sites provide. Traditionally, Yahoo had no support for that type of thing. Yahoo does have support for that type of thing. So they've migrated into that space that Google's in, and their calendaring application, they're about to launch a big new, well, the calendar's actually only launched. They're about to launch a new maps system that's very similar to Google's, but it's got full API support. So there seems to be a lot of inroads of Yahoo trying to be more like Google, and they're succeeding in a lot of ways.
They're trying to make their stuff more open source.
That's right.
Not as tied down.
Yeah. That's right. So
interesting.
We could see a swing back. I mean, Yahoo used to be the big player. It was the big one up for a long time. All right, we are running to that half hour point where I'd like to invite people to participate in the show. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll free at 1-800-655-5877. GeekSpeak is proudly sponsored by Business with Pleasure, a full service business center in Felton offering color printing, design, computer rentals, delivered office supplies, shipping via FedEx, UPS, DHL, and more. Details, businesswithpleasure.com. You're listening to GeekSpeak. Our phone answerer and fellow web geek is waiting for your calls. Rick Philman is at the phone. 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877. We'll take any questions or comments about technology you care to ask us. We might not answer them correctly, but we'll definitely try. Tomorrow morning, 7 a.m., morning edition from NPR, 9 a.m., Car Talk, and at 10 a.m., This American Life. So this morning we had morning edition, and then we went into, of course, Dr. Dawn Motika's Health Matters, and then Geek Speak. And after Geek Speak, of course, we're going to continue with great music. Castle Cottage will join us after this, and that's at 11. And tomorrow, wonderful talk as well, and into music. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The geeks this morning are Chris Dunphy, Miles Elam, John Tracy, Drew Meyer, and Sean Cleveland. Wow.
That's a lot of geeks.
A lot of smart brains await your calls and questions. Phone numbers, 476-2800, toll free at 1-800-655-5877. That's a lot to say.
Yeah. Of course, also, I'm curious, does anyone know the group of geeks? Like, for example, you have a pod of whales or a gaggle of geeks.
It's a gaggle.
Gaggle of geeks.
A bite of geeks?
I think it's
babble of geeks.
A block.
Perhaps.
A packet of geeks?
A packet.
Ooh, a packet of geeks.
I like that's good. Good.
Ooh, I like that. I like bite of geeks, too.
It's better than just plain old network.
Yeah, don't bite the geek.
The email address for us, well, you can't really find an email address, but you can find a great web form to send email to all of us, and that's at geekspeak.org. Just click on Contact Us. All right, let's continue with our discussion. The next discussion topic that I wanted to hit was about municipalities and technology and how some places, the local governments actually supporting free Wi-Fi or other services. Miles, you know most about this topic at this point, please.
Well, I was thinking along the lines of, yes, you have the sexy topics like, oh, there's free Wi-Fi in New York City in some places or San Francisco and the like.
It's funny how you define sexy, but go on.
Well, I mean, just having information, I mean, this is something that gets people excited. They go like, oh, I can check the internet just by walking around downtown or in a park or something like that. But actually what I wanted to focus on more were the things that weren't quite so upfront, things that people didn't care on a day-to-day basis, per se, although maybe they should. One story that came up recently was that Wisconsin Governor Jim Doyle has signed in legislation that will require that touchscreen voting machines used in elections be open source. This being that all the code that's in it is open source and is that anyone who requests that code can get it to review it to make sure that they can trust it, because basically a program is math and logic. And math and logic can be proven. You can go in, you can look, and you can see. This isn't like a general PC where the software is so complex you can't get a handle on it. A voting machine is a very specific set of problems. And as such, it should be something that you can prove logically. And this is the first that I've heard of it, where they're saying that it will require that the code is available and that a paper ballot of your votes comes out, and that the person who's voting gets a verification of what they voted for on a paper document that they can see, and then they can dispose of it.
Yeah, but if you're voting for a lot of different measures, and, you know, it that could be a really long form. How long is it going to take to verify that?
Well, this is something along the lines of, when you're voting, you're choosing which things you are. These are just showing the things that you voted for. Look down the list and make sure that...
Receipt? Sure, okay.
Yeah, making
sure
that
it's just a laundry list of everything you voted for.
Right, just making sure that, you know, the person you voted for president is the person that's on that list. The person that you voted for your representative is the person that's on that list.
So does it spit out this list while you're in the voting booth?
Yes.
Okay, and then you just take that, fold it up or whatever? And
well, no, the electronic voting machine will have the information. You keep the piece of paper, or you can dispose of it, burn it,
Miles,
whatever
who,
you want.
Miles, who's enforce? Who's wanting this and enforcing this right now?
The state of Wisconsin. It's been signed into law by the governor
wow.
of the state.
Wow. So is this only in situations where electronic voting is being used?
Right.
Okay, so basically he's saying, got to be open source, got to be have a paper trail that the user gets.
Right, there has to be a trust relationship.
All those weaknesses in electronic computing, electronic voting traditionally, they're saying don't do that.
Right.
I'd love to see how that works. I mean, it'd be great if a state actually piloted something that functioned of that nature.
Yeah, from what I can see from this description, it's obvious that they're not going to be using Diebold machines. But
you think?
Yeah. And in related news.
But you know what? Isn't the problem that the data is compromised later?
What keeps somebody from looking at the database of votes and changing it
yeah,
later?
That's okay.
Well, see, what's the problem? I mean, the thing is, your name is not associated with a vote. That's always been the case. For example, when you are making a paper ballot, someone can break in and find the box that has all of the ballots.
Electronic
and
stuffing.
Well, even if it's not electronic, even if it's paper, someone could break into the ballot box, look in, and see how everyone was voting. That's
but, finding but the just like in this system, you have access all of a sudden to use the system because you're a registered voter, but in no way are you recorded who it is that's making right. which vote, which is good.
But as far as breaking into the database and injecting information in,
still
that's the whole point behind this open source initiative, so that people can look and review the code.
And make sure no one can do that.
Right.
Including the company that actually runs it.
It's a finite problem. It is logically solvable. You can logically prove because it is just math. It is just logic.
Mm-hmm.
That software cannot be broken into.
And the great thing is the open source aspect of it. If there are potential problems, you can really investigate them quite simple.
Right. And it's not trusting the vendor who made
right.
it. It's
trusting the general consensus behind it. Kind of like a...
Being able to trust it, being able to look at it yourself.
Miles, I know that if I let you keep telling us about more stuff, it would be fascinating, but we have a lot of callers that are waiting for us, so we're going to go on to that. Kevin from Watsonville, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hi.
I am more of an art nerd than a true geek, and so my question is more of the social implications of the Human Genome Project. I see, like, perhaps that more people would be noticing similarities between their music that they've copyrighted and somebody else's music. Say, you know, oh, his melody's only got two notes different from mine, and this could lead to more lawsuits. And could possibly stifle creativity.
Okay, so you're talking about the project, the Pandora.com
yes.
site that kind of groups music together. Well, I think they're not really doing analysis of the melody as much as the feelings, the stylistic feels from people.
Uh-huh.
So you can take, you know, pretty much, you'll get the idea that there's genres of music. Oh, this is, I mean, to simplify things, this is pop rock. I mean, that kind of genre that we always talk about when we're we're dealing with music, what kind of music you listen to.
I doubt they're making their information available, because that would be...
About the algorithms?
Yeah, the algorithms, because that's kind of their intellectual property.
I mean, I get what you're saying, that if there's a large database that says this music's like this music, then the bands that are being compared to could say, oh, these people are copying us.
But then you'd have to copyright a music style.
Yeah. The way they do it is very stylistic, and you could actually, while you're listening to a song in Pandora, you could click on it and say, why are you playing this song? And it'll say, well, you've got a Rush channel set up, and this band here has a lot of really intense rhythms and guitar solos and high vocals, and that's why we've matched it with your Rush channel. And so they'll explain, actually, why they match things, and it's really kind of cool to actually see that analysis happening.
Okay. Well, it always, one, you know, considering Western music as usually working with 8 notes at a time, it's amazing there's not more lawsuits.
You'd think that there were songs that have a lot more of that. I mean, the famous one, of course, is... Pressure Drop and what's the ice?
Under Pressure and Vanilla Ice.
Under Pressure from Queen.
And Ice Ice Baby.
Ice Ice Baby, which is like a melody absolute copy. And that's a really good example case. I don't even know how that case turned out.
Or the Supremes suing George Harrison for My Sweet Lord versus He's So Fine.
Right.
Didn't Madonna just get in trouble for that not long ago? She ripped somebody off? Yeah.
Well, you know, it's interesting because music's all about picking up other music.
I mean, that's what
it's about. I mean, it's frustrating that we see so
how
much legality.
Hear people say
it.
My influences are Stevie Wonder and Bob Dylan and
copyright infringement. Know. Copyright infringement. Yeah. Well, thank you for the call.
Thanks for listening.
All right, thanks, John. Thanks so much.
Enjoy your show. Bye.
Thanks. Bye. All right, well, we're going to just keep on going on. If you'd like to join us, there's a couple lines open. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. In Santa Cruz, Cynthia, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi, I want to apologize in advance for such a very stupid elemental question.
There are never such things. Things.
Come on, Cynthia.
Please.
I've had several instances in the last few months in my home computer where I type on the keyboard, but nothing registers on the screen. I've checked the connections. The connections are fine. I get frustrated. Turn it off. Turn it back on. Still nothing. So I say, okay, I can't use the computer today. And I'm just wondering...
And then does this solve itself at some point?
Well, every now and then it happens, but for the most part, I'm able to type whenever I want to type. But it just won't do it anywhere.
Do you have a keyboard tray that holds your keyboard?
Yes.
Okay. I think I know the problem. Is it under the desk? Does it slide out from under the desk?
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, what's happening is your computer tray, when you slide it in and out, the top row keys get hit by the desk, and it holds them down and locks your keyboard. If you push the keyboard down or out a little bit further and make sure it's not happening, you'll have control of your keyboard again.
You might try that anyway.
Well, I'm almost sure. I'm sitting in front of it now, and...
Is it working or not working?
No, what's happening is that the top of the desk doesn't even come close to touching the top
man.
Of the keyboard.
I was thinking that, too.
Even sometimes when you're pulling it out and sitting with it?
There's no way it can touch it.
Okay, the reason I mentioned is you'd be surprised how often this happens, that those computer trays, when you pull them out, you don't need those top keys most of the time. And if they're being held down somehow because of the way the physically is being pulled out, your keyboard won't function. It's exactly like that. So that's why I suggested it. So when you have that problem again, check that. Any other geeks?
One other thing. I've had a keyboard stop working before in USB keyboards, and if you unplug the keyboard and plug it back in while the computer's still on, sometimes that will reset the circuitry inside the keyboard and fix the problem there.
But if it's not a USB keyboard, if it's a PS2 keyboard, the round kind, you do not want to unplug it and plug it back in while the computer's on.
Because you
can actually fry that part on your motherboard.
Okay, yeah.
And that may be what happened.
It's not round. It's this long one. I don't know.
Are you on a Macintosh or Windows machine?
No, I'm on a Windows machine.
Okay, so you're a USB on a Windows machine. Well...
I mean, I'm just wondering if there might be some problem with the circuitry inside the keyboard.
You know what? Take the keyboard and stick it in the dishwasher on the top rack.
No.
That is a joke.
Spring for and buy another keyboard.
You can get a really cheap keyboard from
$15.
I know what the problem is.
Just to test it.
It's a BIOS setting. So
you think?
Yeah, there are various USB settings in your system BIOS, and one of those is keyboard legacy. And you have to enable that.
Wait, hold on.
Why would it work?
Why would it be intermittent though?
Yeah.
It's got USB.
No, that wouldn't.
It'd be
there on or off.
If it's disabled, I don't know. It's just the nature of PCs. Sometimes things work, sometimes things don't.
The problem with that is if she's got a legacy keyboard that's not going to function, it's not going to load during boot.
Ever,
so she's never going to be able to actually get into the BIOS with that keyboard.
Well, that's the thing. You wouldn't have access to the keyboard until you got into Windows and the driver was loaded.
Yeah. So,
how many hours would somebody spend trying to troubleshoot?
You know what? A keyboard's like $24.
Yeah, try buying a new keyboard first.
Probably
off.
A good
and,
idea.
And you can always return that keyboard if it's not the solution.
Right, okay.
But if you
still have a problem, email the geeks and I can walk you through changing that BIOS setting.
Or rather, go to the website and click contact us.
Yeah, and we'll answer it definitely. Right. But good luck. And you know what? That's not a stupid question at all. That's exactly why we're here to help out with that.
Well, you know, when you sit down and you want to use it and you want to type something, and when you can't do it, you have no choice.
No use.
Can you still use the mouse when this is happening?
Yes.
Okay.
Good question.
So it's not the computer is frozen. It's just that the keyboard isn't.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you very much.
I can do other things. I can find places. I just can't use the keyboard.
Cynthia, thank you very much for the call.
All
bye-bye. Right.
Bye.
All right. From Aromas, we've got Bob. Welcome, Bob, to Geek Speak.
Yeah. I just built a computer, and what I want to do is I have a bunch of old 8mm film. And I have a DV camcorder, and I'm going to convert that into a DV.
Uh-huh.
So what I wanted to know was is there somebody that has some way of converting this over without the flicker that I've been getting?
What's the first video format that you're actually converting from?
Excuse me?
Well, you've got your source that you're trying to copy. What is it?
Is it 8mm?
8mm. And so you've got a projector, and you're trying to record it and not get the flicker.
Right.
Okay. Have you played a lot with the video camera settings?
I've tried some of them, and slowing down the speed and the rest of it on both the projector and the camera. As the projector starts having to pull less film through it, it speeds up or slows down, and the flicker will come back.
Well, there are a lot of service bureaus that handle this. Chris, you have a suggestion?
I was going to say exactly that. That if you really want good quality, you're not going to be able to film the projected film. You're going to have to use a film scanner to scan it frame at a time, and there are service bureaus that'll do that for a certain amount per reel of tape. Yeah,
and there are cheaper service bureaus that will copy it via projection systems that are specifically designed for that.
Yeah.
The real trick you're running into is that the camera's pickup, the CCD of the digital camera, is better than the human eye, or I should say less. Yeah, it's different. It's less forgiving than the human eye. So the human eye really sees the image as one full image, but that CCD is going to pick up frames that are black in between. You could try slowing down your camera's pickup, but what will happen is that the duration between flashes will reduce so that you'll see it every once in a while, and it'll be more like a line going through it or something. I think there's pretty much nothing you can do to have that flicker in there. But what I would try to do, if you want to save money and everything, is record these things completely in their entirety with the flicker in there and assume that you're going to be able to find some post-production work that can get rid of the flicker. That's my feeling on it. Any other... Sean, are you doing some searching on some solutions of that nature? Is that... No, you're just doing some... Okay. Well, I
really don't know much about this area at all.
I would go with the service bureau if you care about the footage a lot. If you're just concerned about getting a copy of it before the film degrades so much you can't use it, I would go ahead and record it like you're doing and later on try to deal with the flickers being removed. I'm assuming there's software to take care of that problem.
Okay. What I was going to say was... there's nothing that you know of out there, a company that, for the average guy to buy from to be able to take it home.
That's what Google's for, Bob.
what I'll do, Bob, is anybody out there have the feeling, have this experience of taking 8mm and getting it transferred successfully, probably to DVD? If you've had that problem and then had it solved in the Monterey Bay area, Central Coast, California, where we are, please go ahead and give us a call. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. If you're at your computer and want to just email us, go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. Bob, I know one body that does this, the Media Services and Library at UCSC does this, but I think it's only for faculty and students there, but you can give it a shot.
Okay. Okay.
You might want to call them.
They might have
some suggestions.
Call the library at UCSC, I think, is the best solution. Okay, good luck, Bob, and we'll let you know if anybody has a solution. All right.
All right.
And also a Bob from Scotts Valley this time. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Hey, I just had a weird problem recently with my PC, and I wondered if I could get your take on it. I've been getting notices from my Norton installed on my machine that my, I guess, term has run out and I need to renew. And I've been getting these, and the Norton was installed by a computer repair place about a year ago, so I had no idea of subscription or anything yet. So I was kind of just putting it off and clicking, you know, renew later. All of a sudden, recently, this last week, I got the notice again. I clicked it off, and then all of a sudden, my screen blanks out. I get this big red and black danger virus warning, you're infected, and this program is all of a sudden on my screen scanning my files. The program is called Spy Sheriff.
You didn't invite this thing in your house?
No, it's just all of a sudden on my screen, it's downloading my files. I go, well, wait a minute.
Man.
But it's like, it's downloading, you know, and it's scanning my files, and it's all these severe and dangerous.
Sounds spyware-ish.
Yeah, it sounds like they're trying to fake you into doing something. So
well,
I
that's what I thought. So I finally took it in, you know, and so I can't do anything with it. When I went to Control-Alt-Delete to, you know, close out the program, it says your administrator won't allow this.
Oh, man.
So I took it down to the cruise I own, Santa Cruz, who's now doing repairs, and the first thing they got back to me and told me was the Spy Sheriff is like a spyware virus in itself.
Yep, it sure is.
And so I'm wondering if this is, like, connected to Norton. Could Norton be behind it?
No. So here's what's going on. You had your Norton there, and the subscription ran out, and you got infected by visiting a site or opening an email, or somehow you got infected.
Mm-hmm.
There's a program called Drysoft AVG, which is a free antivirus. You can Google it and find that.
Drysoft?
It's
G-R-I-S-O-F-T. G-R-I-S-O-F-T.
Frank Television, F-T.
Okay.
And Grisoft AVG, and if you Google Grisoft AVG, you'll find there's a commercial version, and then there's a free home user version.
Mm-hmm.
So you can actually download that and install it, and it's a pretty solid program.
Mm-hmm.
The other choice is you can go to Symantec or CA or Trend Micro, and they have programs that are kind of like house call programs
mm-hmm.
that will scan your machine remotely. They won't download and protect you, but they'll help you recover from a problem.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of future prevention, which web browser and which email client do you use right now?
Outlook Express is my email, and I'm using
the big blue E.
Yeah.
Okay. When you get your system cleaned off and set to go, I highly recommend you stop using Internet Explorer and Outlook Express.
Oh, really?
You can choose, for example, Firefox or Opera.
Uh-huh.
Are two good choices for web browser.
Uh-huh.
Both of those you can find by Googling. And
there's an email client called Thunderbird that's also capable.
Right.
Yeah.
What's that called, email?
Thunderbird. And that will import all of the mail that you have in Outlook Express. You're not going to lose anything if you do that.
Uh-huh.
Outlook Express and Outlook, a sister project, and Internet Explorer are the top ways that people get viruses these days on Windows.
Really?
So if you switch off of that, you're automatically reducing your threat. You know.
Your likelihood, anyway.
Yeah.
What was the email again? Thunderbird?
Thunderbird. Yeah. Firefox and Thunderbird
are partners.
If you go to
mozilla.org,
uh-huh.
you can find both Firefox and Thunderbird there.
Isn't
mozilla.com now.
Yeah. Isn't Mozilla like a firewall?
No.
Because I have that on my desktop.
It's not a firewall, it's a web browser.
Yeah, yeah. Mozilla was an integrated browser and email client that's kind of gone away.
Uh-huh.
And now Mozilla has Firefox and Thunderbird. They're two independent applications, one for email, one for browsing.
Okay. The virus software, the virus removal software that Drew just mentioned, Grisoft, is free, F-R-E-E dot G-R-I-S-O-F-T dot com.
Oh, I'm sorry, you went too
fast. It's free dot Grisoft dot com.
Grisoft. Oh,
okay. That'll take you right to that free home user version.
Yeah, and I want to go ahead and go on to other people, and thank you so much, Bob, for calling.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Good luck, Bob. You're a perfect example of 2005 living.
Yeah, dealing with viruses and protection. Yeah, if you're using good virus software and it starts to expire, deal with it. And if you want to go with free, go for it. But definitely,
don't just let it lapse.
Yeah.
And I've actually seen how SpySheriff works. It's one of those warning. It's a web pop-up that says, "Warning, your computer is infected." Uh-huh. And when you click on that warning that says your computer is infected, then click here to get the download SpySheriff. You then it becomes true because SpySheriff is the infection.
Self-inflicting. You've just agreed to
it. So what's the name of the company? What's the name of the product that's actually an infection?
SpySheriff.
There's a gazillion of these. Don't click stuff you don't understand.
Yeah, and actually don't respond to web ads, right? Don't respond to web ads or spam. It's just a general rule.
Nice to say, don't click anything you don't understand, but unfortunately with computers, especially Windows PCs, that's not a safe bet.
90%.
And you really need the really expensive version of Norton to find the spyware. A lot of people don't have that version, so you have to rely on other software to remove spyware and malware.
And we are
Norton's more of an antivirus software.
Now, the Microsoft anti-spyware, which you can get at Microsoft.com, is actually free and is a pretty decent way to find and remove spyware. And so if you have a Windows PC and you don't have Microsoft's anti-spyware installed, go to Microsoft.com and download it. And you
really? This is the first I've ever heard of it.
There's a new beta program there.
It's in beta, but it works really, really well. Right. And
what's the website for that?
Microsoft.com.
I think it's called Live, Microsoft Live now.
It's going to be rolled into Live, but you could find it. It's like their top download. If you go to Microsoft.com, click on downloads, you'll see Microsoft anti-spyware beta, and I've cleaned up a lot of people with that, and it works really well.
Thank you, Chris. Stop using Internet Explorer.
Except for that, probably. Thank you, Chris, for the call. We're going to go ahead and go to Josh in Los Osos. Okay, we lost Josh. All right, we'll go to, let's see, how about
Windows One Care Live.
How about Sheila?
Search that, you'll find it.
Windows One Care Live. Sheila from Santa Cruz, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. How you doing?
Quite well, thank you.
Good. I appreciate the new time zone. So we have both of those two you've got to get rid of, and Outlook Express, Internet Explorer, and we're listening as far as replacing those. My son is listening. He's actually the geek in our house. Mm-hmm. And
woo, yeah.
But what happens is I can't send photos. My brother can't send photos. The computer kicks him out and says Outlook Express has protected you from this dangerous attachment. And I'm talking about just a straight photo from my camera, even.
Mm-hmm. Isn't Outlook great?
It's wonderful. I've got a whole new Outlook.
They're trying to protect you from accidentally making a mistake, and they're actually getting in your way.
Right, exactly.
Are you saying when you try to send a message, Outlook tells you, no, don't send this, it's not safe?
No, it hasn't ever happened. It's just importing photos. My brother's tried repeatedly to send me photos, and it's just doggone
irritating. It when you're receiving the photo from your brother, or is it when you're trying to send them out that the message?
No, it's when I'm receiving. I actually haven't tried to send them out on the computer.
Yeah, it's Outlook trying to protect you from downloading anything so it doesn't get infected.
Okay,
I have a question, though. It's very possible that your brother has a virus, and every time they send an email, there's a virus attached, and you're detecting it and getting rid of it.
Okay, except that when I've tried to send them from my own little camera, mm-hmm. got the same gosh darn thing. I've got one picture I'm trying to send. It'll accept some, but this picture's got more detail.
I'm going to go with this solution. I think it's a great one. Download the free Mozilla email client called Thunderbird and start using that instead and see if it solves the problem.
My son's saying that on his desktop he's got that, and we have four desktops, so I don't know.
Well, have your son try to email. Have your son load in and open up Thunderbird because it's already installed and everything, and try to have him send a JPEG on your machine and see if it works.
Well, you also just
But sending out has not been a problem. So you mean sending two?
Yeah, have email sent to his account.
Okay, now, he's saying that he's had a problem, but
he solved it.
Articulate it more?
Go ahead and throw him on. Put him on the phone.
Will you talk to him?
Sure.
Okay, he's too shy. Sorry. I don't want to put him on the spot, but he is the one that is best equipped to deal with these problems. So, anyway, you're saying put Thunderbird in place of Outlook Express.
Yeah, I mean,
in all desktops, which we have no objection to.
Yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense. I mean, you probably won't run into the problems that you see in Outlook. And if you do run into a virus, you'll have less chance of actually getting the virus.
Or you could lower the security.
Yeah, what's happening?
But that's not suggested.
You know what? I looked in the security, and I'm not. Okay, can I just tell you this little note here? Please. This was the media center computer at Circuit City. We got, and it took away all their favorite everythings here locally. It had the movies, the music, you know, everybody loved it that worked there. And we bought the Norton antivirus. Well, it turns out those don't seem to be compatible.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So do you have, is Thunderbird an antivirus thing, or is that a separate thing we need to get?
So Thunderbird's a mail application. It handles your email. Outlook has the early Outlooks were like really good at accepting viruses and infecting your machine.
Right.
So what Microsoft slowly did with Outlook is add in security support. So basically, right, you could go into preferences and say, I want to restrict a whole bunch of access to this email client so it can't do bad things to me,
exactly,
which is really a good thing to do because it can do bad things to you.
Exactly.
But some of those settings, if you set them high enough, will stop you from using the email client to send attachments at all.
And that's what pretty much seems like we're
that
in.
That might be what's happening. So yeah, you could, what we don't recommend, go into Outlook and decrease the security levels in Outlook.
Right.
But then you're going to open yourself up more to viruses.
Right, and we already get a ton of spam, the internet.
Spam,
you know,
spam's not even the same, and that's going to be another problem.
Right.
But Thunderbird is going to start marking your spam for you and help you get rid of it. So
okay,
I highly recommend go to Mozilla.org, click on Thunderbird and download it. But it looks like you already have it on your machine, so get your son to tell you how to transfer, you know, translate
yeah,
it over. And
Thunderbird has what's called adaptive spam filters, which work very well, much
okay,
better than Internet Explorer
okay,
spam filters.
Thank
all
you
right,
very much for the call,
right,
Sheila.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Yeah,
well,
she could go to a webmail client, too, like Yahoo or Google.
All right, Josh is back. We're going to have to not take Judith's call, unfortunately, but we're going to take Josh because you're back. Thank you very much for joining us. Hi.
Hi, yes, I have a question about Boolean searching.
Okay.
And, you know, what are some of the methods of narrowing down your search? Say if I typed in San Luis Obispo, Cal Poly.
Uh-huh.
And I'll get a bunch of things about San Luis Obispo's, you know,
okay,
farmer's market and everything else. And then I'll get Cal Poly down in Southern California.
Miles, sir, please.
So how do you, I mean, how do you make your query so that it gets both of them? Is that your question?
Well, how can we, it just seems like most people have trouble narrowing down their search.
Tell us what Boolean searching is, Miles.
Well, first off, I'm not quite sure what you mean by Boolean
use the operators.
A Boolean logic.
And search.
Yeah, a Boolean logic is referring to and or
right,
not.
Right.
Things like that.
It doesn't seem to work on a lot of search engines.
Right.
Yeah,
it
doesn't.
If you're going in through, for example, Google, you can put things into quotes. Like, for example, if it's a long string of words, like, for example, if you were looking at Cal Poly, it could look for, if you just type in Cal Poly, it'll look for Cal and Poly as separate items.
Right.
That just as an example. If you put it in quotes, you have quote, Cal Poly, end quote, then it'll be looking for just that whole string.
Or San Luis Obispo Cal Poly, all five words, if you enclose them in quotation marks, you'll only get results that contain those five words.
But let's say you're looking for something in San Luis Obispo and Cal Poly, but there happens to be a software company that's in there and it's got all the top hits. And the name of the software company is We Can Do It or something like that. If you put a minus symbol in the front of the word that you don't want to be in the search, Google will remove it. That's like saying a not. A minus sign will remove it. So if let's say you don't want to look at restaurants, you just do dash, you know, minus sign, restaurant, and you won't get any pages with the word restaurant in it. So Google does support that. The and is automatic. There is no or in Google.
Yeah. But it may do things that are just referring to it by reference. The word may not be in it, just be in pages that refer to the page that you're going to. You can mandate that it's going to be in, that word is going to be in your search by putting a plus.
You know, the easy way to do this is go to google.com and click on advanced search.
Right.
And it is really.
Even better idea.
This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing local and nationwide internet services, including DSL 6.0, spam filters, and virus protection. Information about membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. Josh, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
And Geeks, thank you very much for being here today with us. The Geeks this morning, Sean Cleveland, Drew Meyer, Miles Elam, Chris Dumphy, and John Tracy, all were here with me,
Full
Lyle Troxel.
House.
Yahoo!
Woo-hoo.
Our phone answer is
Welcome
Rick Philman. The Geeks, GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of online tonight with Dave and Lawrence and is used by permission. Next week, we're talking about Priuses. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open at daily at 2808 SoCal Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBH San Arturo, on the web at kusp.org. Coming up right now is the Castle Cottage. For KUSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxel. Thanks for joining us.